is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude. So we are taping this show on Wednesday morning, the day before the 4th of July, so that the show will run on Friday, July 5th. We have to thank Scott Braddock, who is going to open the show, and Stefan Schmidt, who's going to close the show, because these gentlemen do yeoman work. They are true patriots in every way, shape, or form. Scott Braddock is the editor of The Quorum Report. He is also affectionately known as the Voice of Texas, and he ain't feeling well today on top of everything else. Oh, my God, you get three more stars to put on your chest.
It's okay, Arnie. We're making America great again. In fact, we're making America Texas.
Well, yes, let's start with that. You saw that this morning. I could not believe it. Donald Trump is knocking New York. And what does he do at the same time as he's knocking New York? He's telling everyone to move to Texas. You must have just, all I kept thinking is, does he know about the U-Hauls already coming in every day to Texas?
Well, he needs to do his homework on that, and that's okay. I like anybody who's boosting Texas. Think about the fact that, on average, 1,100 to 1,200 people move to the great state from lesser states every day. They're coming to Texas. They're moving to the suburbs. They're moving to Austin, unfortunately. The traffic situation in Austin it's unbelievable. Nobody moved to Austin. Thank you.
Especially if you have a scooter.
That's right. But he's sort of directing folks away from what they have been doing, over the last few decades, Arnie. Where do retirees from New York generally move to? They move to Florida. Right. That huge migration south.
Right.
And in Texas, it's people coming primarily from California. We have numbers to back that up, as we've talked about here on the show. If you think about what that does to the politics of the places people are moving to, you think about the fact that, of course, Florida's one of the biggest swing states, and Texas, has seen a huge shift toward the Democratic Party in the last election cycle when 6 years ago, in the last off-year election, you had Democrats losing to their Republican opponents statewide in Texas by 21 points. In 2018, you had Republicans barely eking out their victories, Ted Cruz and Beto O'Rourke in a squeaker of a race within 3 points there. So you can only have it be your public policy priority and your prescription to have people move from other places before it impacts what your electorate looks like.
Exactly. Let me just read you what we're talking about. I sent this to Scott this morning. Trump praises Texas, slams New York. I just love it. In a series of early morning tweets, President Donald Trump blasted New York and seemingly implored Americans to, quote, move quickly to Texas where they are loved. Oh, this is hilarious. People are fleeing New York like never before, the president tweeted. If they own a business, they are twice as likely to flee. And if they are a victim of harassment by the attorney general of the state, I think he's referring to himself. Anyway, what are they going to do to our great National Rifle Association? The president continued his glowing endorsement of Texas at the expense of New York, saying, ready, everyone? Texas will defend them and indemnify them against political harassment by New York State and Governor Cuomo. Oh, my God, the guy's on drugs. Oh, my God.
Well, don't you have in New Hampshire, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have sort of a version of this with people fleeing Massachusetts coming to New Hampshire and in that instance making things a little more Republican, right?
Yes. Well,
it's all the folks who, I wonder, if those folks who were upset about property taxes and other taxes and things that are happening in New York that they might not like. If there are necessarily people who would agree with President Trump on a whole host of issues, I'm not sure that's true. I know that people in Texas who are upset about their property taxes are not, exclusively Republican or Democrat.
Well, and just to add to our conversation, Texas obviously can absorb a lot of people, but as they pointed out in this article, Texas's population continues to grow quickly, adding more people than any other state from July 2017 to July 2018. I just thought it was, and I also felt like the reason why Texas is in his brain is because of your lieutenant governor.
Well, the president's man in Texas, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, the little gov, has been, one of the biggest boosters of the president.
Yes,
Patrick, of course. Dan Patrick brought Trump to Houston last year when Ted Cruz was in that tight race with O'Rourke that we mentioned. And I was at a Republican event in Houston a couple of weeks ago giving a speech to the Greater Houston Pachyderm Club, a bunch of wonderful people who have been Republican activists in the Houston region for a long time.
Okay.
And listen, the lieutenant governor had pitched voters over the last few months on the idea that he basically saved Texas for the Republicans by bringing Trump to the Houston area.
Mm.
And Patrick had said that in certain places in the Houston area, because you know, the president was speaking in the Houston media markets, and of
right.
course that means that there was more exposure for what he was saying about how to keep America great again and everything in Southeast Texas, where Houston is, that helped to backstop Republicans up and down the ballot. Well, when I was at that event in Houston, a Republican activist from Fort Bend County, which is southwest of Houston, one of the suburban counties, Republican activist comes up and says, that is the worst thing he could have done. This is the first time that they could remember that they have countywide officials who are Democrats in that county. And so in those places where people are moving to, when the president says move to Texas, people are moving to the Texas suburbs, places like, and your listeners at KPFT in Houston will know all the places I'm talking about, Fort Bend County, Collin County and Denton
right.
County up around Dallas-Fort Worth, Williamson County
right.
In Austin, which over the last decade have really been rock-ribbed, just rock-solid Republican areas, and now are either on the cusp of becoming Democratic or already went Democratic in the last election. And that, of course, again, was an off-year election. Who knows what that's going to mean
in 2020?
More than, I mean, we had 8.4 million people vote in Texas in 2018, which is double what usually happens in
wow.
Texas during an
that's
off-year
incredible.
Election. So it's those are presidential level numbers
yes.
in the state.
So let me,
and so, well, the question is, what does that mean going forward into 2020? Does that mean, and this is an open question, does that mean that we have sort of topped out around 8.5, 9 million
no.
people who will vote in 2020?
No.
Or does it mean that we will see Republicans and Democrats alike coming out to the polls, you know, at a clip of more like 10 million or 12 million
wow.
people vote in this state, which would be huge.
Well, so a couple of things I was thinking about. One, have you seen the numbers about the debates that happened the other week? And the reason I even mentioned this is how many Republican people were watching the debates. They said it was a huge spike, and a lot of Republicans were watching. So
sure.
the question is, are they watching because they're trying to get material on how they can defend their president, or are they watching because they're beginning to get antsy and maybe Donald Trump isn't the answer? You know what I mean? So it'll be very
fascinating.
There are
a lot of dissatisfied Republicans.
Well, tremendous. And because what we saw with Kamala Harris, which was moving California and Texas to the same day for the presidential primary, was brilliant both on her part now, especially after her performance during the debate, but also brilliant because it will engage Texans in a way that won't just end after the Texas presidential primary, but may in fact infect the election of November. So in a lot of ways, not only do you have people moving in from California, not only did you see what happened in 2018, you have a brilliant strategy by having the same day for the presidential primary. Kamala's doing so well. That can only help people who are, you know, concerned about bringing Democrats out in Texas. This is really, it's getting kind of interesting how states are changing. And even Florida, look at how close the races were in Florida. You're talking about the close races in Texas. Voila, Florida is sort of a bookend to that conversation.
You know, the argument, the theory of the case for Biden, of course, has been that he would be the one to really compete with Trump in the blue-collar Midwest,
right.
Which Secretary Clinton did not do. But as we've talked about here on the show, and by the way, that was a choice to not even go campaign in some of those places. We
exactly.
should remind people of that.
A bad choice.
Part of
a
the
bad
Clinton
choice.
Campaign, not a good choice. But look, there's, you know, either going back and relitigating the 2016 election, which seems to be all they ever do on cable news anymore, at least for the last 2 years, or, which is why I can't watch it, or two, move forward to the next election. Keep this in mind, and I think even Democrats forget this, there are more Democrats in the United States than Republicans.
Right.
Right. I mean,
right.
just look at the election.
Right.
The Democrats don't have a numbers problem. They have a distribution problem.
Exactly.
The voters just live in places where, you know, in a lot of cases they don't matter.
Right.
So, you know, in California, if you have 2 million extra votes, it doesn't matter. You already got those votes locked down. I think if the next person who's going to be the nominee for the Democratic Party is thinking forward, they'll be thinking about changing the map the same way that
right.
President Obama did when
right.
he flipped states like Colorado, for example, which is not even thought of by Republican consultants anymore as a state that they can really potentially win.
Mm-hmm.
When it used to be, you know, rock-solid Republican. Now
exactly.
it's a Democratic state. If you look at what happened in the industrial Midwest with Trump, those are Democratic areas, right? And no one took seriously the idea that Trump could win in those places. Maybe you did, Arnie. You can correct me if I'm wrong. But you look at this fact that he was able to change the map. Obama changed the map. You would think if the pendulum's going to swing again, the map would have to be remade again.
You know, you're absolutely right. It's going to be so interesting to see the dynamic and what happens. This was not on your list, but you sent something out to me this morning, and I want to give you an opportunity to respond to this. You sent me an article, and the article was from the Orlando Weekly, and it's about an immigration discussion about sanctuary cities.
Yeah.
So why don't you take this opportunity to talk about this, because I think this is an important conversation, especially now when we're seeing what's happening along the border, what we're seeing at the detention camps, what we're seeing now from the report that just came out that went into a lot of these, you know, detention camps, both in Texas as well as Florida. AOC has been saying about them is now echoed in these reports, and they're even more horrific in some ways than even what AOC was suggesting.
Yeah, the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General came out with this report that shows that in these detention centers along the Texas border in the Rio Grande Valley, you have conditions that are squalid. It's overcrowded in there. There are these conditions in a widespread kind of way. It's not isolated. The report describes standing room only cells.
Mm-hmm.
Where, of course, people can't sleep if they're having to stand up for hours on end, days on end. Children without showers and hot meals, and detainees are clamoring desperately to be released. Detainees who, by the way, are trying to. Can we underscore this and take a breath, take a pause as we think about July 4th and we think about the United States of America. And we think about all the promise of America and all of that. Arnie, these are people who are trying to legally enter
the United States.
These are refugees. These are asylum seekers who are coming here. And by the way, I saw the Texas director of Breitbart.com making the argument that I just made. There were right-wing people saying to him on social media that these people are illegal and they shouldn't be coming in here. And he said, actually, you know, until their asylum claim has been denied, they're actually trying to legally come into the United States.
Right.
So you folks who are saying that ought to back up. But in Florida, they have done something that we have experience with in Texas, which is they have passed a ban on so-called sanctuary cities, Arnie, which I haven't gotten all the way down into the weeds of what they did in Florida, although I'm sure it looks a lot like what was passed in Texas in 2017, and I think about 10 other states around the country. There is no legal definition for what a sanctuary city is. That's
mm-hmm.
number one. The bill that was passed in Texas makes no attempt to create a legal definition for what that means. It's this sort of hateful, anti-immigrant rhetoric and enacted as law, saying that in any community where the police are not rounding up undocumented people and taking them to jail and, you know, calling ICE for deportation, if you're not doing that, then that's how the argument goes, then you need to be denied certain funds as a municipality. And this is just so ridiculous and counterproductive on multiple levels. In Texas, Houston is often criticized as a quote-unquote sanctuary city because for decades there's been a standing order in Houston among the Houston Police Department that says that officers are not to ask about immigration status if they encounter somebody on the street.
Right.
Now, if they take them to the jail, they can do that, right? And they already do that in Houston and in other places. But just seeing a cop, people who live in these communities should not be worried about whether they're going to be asked about that. There are at least 600,000 undocumented people in the Houston area, and guess what? Crime happens in the neighborhoods where they live just like crime happens in other people's neighborhoods, and they need to be able to come forward whenever they are either a witness to a crime or the victim of a crime, and the police in Houston have made the case and elsewhere have made the case. By the way, police chiefs almost, I think, uniformly in this state were against this quote-unquote crackdown on sanctuary cities because it's a public safety issue.
Exactly.
You should not be putting up a barrier. But once again, there are enough barriers between people of color and people who are driving police cars.
Right.
And so here we go again. It's another barrier between the cops and the people they're supposed to be serving and protecting. And I have had people commenting on this Florida situation saying that, you know, that Texas, this is a comment that was made overnight in my social media feeds from some folks who were maybe uninformed. They said, why doesn't Texas pass a sanctuary cities ban like Florida just did? Otherwise, Democrats are going to take over Texas. And I simply made the point that in 2017, sanctuary cities ban was passed by the Texas legislature. And then the very next year, Democrats closed a 20-point gap with Republicans in an off-year election.
Ooh,
I don't think
touche.
Political consulting is in that guy's future.
Oh, God. All right. So let me just – I want to go back really quickly to the how we sort of began our conversation, which was that report from the Homeland Security Watchdog Group about the severe overcrowding. So I did two things on my Facebook page, Scott.
Okay.
One was there was a report that came out at the beginning of June in my state about 105 dogs seized from squalid Bradford, New Hampshire home. And they talked about the conditions of the dogs. And as I was reading about the conditions of the dogs, I realized, wow, this paralleled the conditions that you saw in the Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General report. And I said, maybe we need to bring in the ASPCA for someone to react quickly to remedy the situation at the border. We protect animals and expect government to come to their rescue. But human beings at the border are being treated in a cruel and inhumane way by what? By the government.
Well,
so I want – I mean, it's just – it's incredible. People are outraged. Look at these dogs. Look at how they're being fed. Look at how they're living. They're not getting showers. They're not getting this. And I'm going, excuse me, almost word for word, it sounded like it came from the Homeland Security report.
Interesting. And I'm not trying to be provocative here, but over the last couple of decades of doing broadcast news, anytime there would be a story about animal cruelty, people would be rightly angry about that. I was always interested in the order of magnitude. People always seem to be more angry about that than, you know, violations of human rights in the United States and around the world. I think they ought to be angry about both, by the way. But I, you know, it's unfortunate, Arnie, that you have Democrats in this country, and you'll get what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Democrats in this country only get outraged about this stuff when they see what's happening with an actual humanitarian crisis along the border. There is genuine outrage among liberals and some Republicans as well about what's happening, you know, in the situation. But the Republican side, at least among the base of the Republican Party, their outrage level never changes no matter what's going on. They're always angry about what's happening on the border. You know, over the last 15 years, you had Mexican net migration go to zero and at some points go to net negative migration from Mexico because of the economic policies that the United States entered into when it comes to the North American Free Trade Agreement, which, of course, is being renegotiated now, the USMCA and all that. And you have Republicans who would still be angry even if almost no one was coming in from Mexico. They would still say that the border is out of control. You have Democrats who get upset about this when they see these images, rightly. But it's an interesting thing that the outrage is so durable and so sustainable on the Republican side, no matter what the apprehension numbers are either. And you know, over the years, you know, I've seen the you know, folks like Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, Little Dan, say that, look, we have so many apprehensions, that means the border's out of control. Or if the numbers were down, he would say, well, you know, we've got all these people who are trying to come in, and we're having great success in stopping them. So no matter what the numbers are, they can make an argument for why you should be angry about it. And on the Democratic side, it seems to only be during the summer migration season that people are angry.
Well, and then last but not least, I have to give you my other Facebook post. I'm on a roll this morning because I'm so upset.
Really?
I'm so upset. So again, they were showing the pictures of the dangerous overcrowding. And you know the story about the people that were standing room only for a week. They only had packing people in like sardines for a week where you can't even sleep because there's no place to lay down. And I wrote, when you read stories of slave ships coming from Africa, you may recognize similar conditions created by our government today. It's unbelievable. I went back and looked at some of those stories about how they packed them in to these slave ships and how they were literally layered up and how they were standing room only. And then I'm reading this and I'm going, oh, my God. Tell me how these are not concentration camps. Tell me how these do not actually, you know, mirror slave ships. This is who we are. That's the part that makes me out of my mind, Scott. Cruelty is their feature. Cruelty is their – that's the agenda. Oh, my Lord.
Well, to underscore your point, the president himself has said that you know, the harsh treatment of folks along the border, including the family separations that happened over the course of the last year, really amped up over the last year, he has said that that is meant to be a deterrent for people coming into the United States. The problem with that, of course, is that if it's supposed to be a deterrent, it does not work because we have record numbers of people who are seeking asylum.
Right.
I will go back to the point about economics, and that's how you actually fix this. I was talking with some business guys over the last couple of days who were in the United States on business. They came in from Sweden, and they were talking about the idea that, you know, if you listen to the president, you would think that you just have hordes of horrible people coming into the United States all the time. And, of course, when they get here, they look around, they realize, of course, that's not true at all. And, you know, I took them right back to the economic argument. In the United States, entering into trade agreements with Mexico and Canada created a middle class south of the border, meaning that people did not need, they were not desperate to feed their kids the way they had been before.
Right.
And so they are not coming in the same numbers that they did when I was a kid, you know, more than 20 years ago, and so 25 years ago. And so now you have people coming from a different part of the world who are desperate because of economic conditions in Central America, because of the drug cartels running things down there. They're fleeing violence. They're fleeing poverty. And I would say, and I think you can help me with this, Arnie, I certainly don't hear President Trump talking about how to address that. And I don't know that I'm hearing a lot from the Democratic candidates either about, you know, about articulating a policy towards Central America that helps to improve their situation so that we can have the same kind of success. Here's the they don't have to reinvent the wheel. We've done this before. We've made you know, situations in these countries better previously, and there's always different challenges in different nations. But they need to get on the ball with that.
Well, it's all, I mean, the idea of a Marshall Plan for Latin America. I mean, think about how much money we're spending now on detention and ICE and what is it, $700 or $800 per person. I mean, the cost is astronomical. It's getting more expensive by the day. Instead of taking some of those dollars and reinvesting them in something that can stabilize the situation in El Salvador and Guatemala, that can actually help them to give them what they really desperately need, which is security and economic security. They need physical security. And they need economic security. And that is the thing that makes me crazy. Instead, he's pulling resources out as opposed to investing resources. This guy, he wants to create the problem he's seeing because this is not about us. It is about his reelect in 2020. He is going to use immigration as his bloody shirt. That is what he wants to do. And of course, Stephanie just handed me something. And of course, a lot of these are going to private contractors. So the private contractors want to see this continue. President Trump wants to see this continue. So he wants to create and foment this challenge. He doesn't want to solve it.
Our political leadership will always continue to do more of what the voters reward. And in 2016, that's what they did for Trump on this issue.
So I want to talk a little bit about Austin's mayor. This is such a fascinating story. You sent me a link and you said Austin's mayor comes under fire from Governor Greg Abbott and President Trump after the city legalized camping for the homeless in public areas. Tell me about this. This is such an interesting response by the mayor.
Well, the mayor and the city council in Austin over the weekend, late Friday, they did the city council meetings where they vote on these big ordinances on, you know, or late in the week. And 4 hours of testimony before city council, they had proposed a few things. And, of course, like a lot of major metros, we do have a serious homelessness problem in Austin. And the mayor and city council said that they wanted to sort of, quote, unquote, decriminalize people who are homeless. And so they said in all public areas, except for City Hall and parks and a few other places, the folks can camp out anywhere they like. And this, of course, is not going over well with a lot of people. This is one of those eye-level issues. You see the consequences instantly of what the policy is. And, of course, Austin, once again, giving Governor Abbott all the ammunition he needs to take aim at every municipal government in the state and saying he's going to move to overturn the ordinance, you know, at the state level.
So what's his answer for the homeless? What is Governor what is Governor Greg Abbott's answer?
None.
Thank you.
Thank you. That's right. So the it's easy to understand. But city council member who pushed this, a guy named Greg Kassar, had said to the governor in a, through the media in a statement, he said, you know, we did more last week to address homelessness, from funding services to buying a new shelter to fixing laws than Governor Abbott did in his entire 6 months of the last legislative session. As we know, so many people who are on the streets are, you know, those who suffer with mental illness. And, you know, we have made some progress on the mental health care issue in Texas, I would say. That's one of sort of the legacy projects of the former Speaker of the House, Joe Strauss, who, you know, helped to shape the policy that was just passed by the Texas legislature, which is to invest a lot more money in that issue, which really need to do in the state. But of course, those things take a long time to implement those things. And by the way, they have to have sustained funding. So, you know, we had a legislative session in which there was lots of extra money on the table and people were willing to spend it this time around. But, of course, when we have a recession in 2 years or 4 years, you know, knock on wood, hopefully we don't, but you will at some point, you'll see what the government does at that point, which would be to cut these sorts of services first.
That's right. You have to put your mental illness on the shelf. We'll call you in 2 years, and then you can be mentally ill again, and we'll respond to you. It's just absolutely disgusting. We only have a minute left. Tell me about your thoughts about Julian Castro. I mean, what is Texas talking about? He had the biggest spike. He's almost got enough contributions now to make it to the next debate. I mean, he's a couple of thousand away, which means he can easily make it. But he really is the conversation. He and Kamala are really what people are talking about, in part because it was the first time people actually, I think, really recognized their potential ability and also began to understand that maybe this is someone you should really sort of think about in a very different way.
You know, he acted very much out of character.
That's what I was
going to debate. I mean, you know, he sometimes gets aggravated because media in Texas will say that he's cautious. That's usually one of the descriptions of him. But it has been the case over his career that he's been very cautious in the moves that he's making. But I think he understood that he really needed to come out swinging and made the calculated decision to do that against the other Texan in the race. Looking at the national poll averages right now, he's still not at 2%, which, of course, is part of the threshold for being on the next debate stage. So we'll see if he gets there and can ride this momentum, you know, to continue to be a viable candidate.
All right. So now take care of yourself. Lots of tea, lots of honey. I know you hate this stuff.
Anyways, all that.
I know. Thanks, I love you, Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is known affectionately as the Voice of Texas. He is the editor of the Quorum Report. He did yeoman's work. He's a true patriot because he showed up on Wednesday morning to tape our show for Friday. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week and feel
better. Yes, you're a great American, Arnie.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. I got my cap to prove it. All right. Stick around, everyone. A little Stefan Schmidt. He's the voice of Iowa, or Dr. Politics will be joining us next.
Technology goes out on a limb for clean water on this CurrentCast. Trees slow, absorb, and purify rainfall. That helps decrease runoff and stormwater pollution. Now, a software tool called iTree Hydro helps city and regional planners measure the exact water benefits of tree cover versus impervious services in their community. Ted Andreni of the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry says by simulating the impacts of adding more trees,
the model will illustrate reduction in the total volume of stormwater, the slowing of the peak stormwater, and a reduction in the total amount of pollutants in the stormwater.
This provides information that communities can use to better protect their local waters. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
I see the hand writing on the wall.
Oh, hand
writing. Put your hands together.
Somebody said,
oh.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And as I reminded you at the very beginning of the show, we are taping the show on Wednesday, the day before the 4th of July, to air on Friday, the day after the 4th of July. And just like Scott Braddock, Stefan Schmidt is a true patriot. He is a professor of political science at Iowa State, affectionately known as Dr. Politics. He and Arnie have been doing radio for God knows how many decades now. And you can hear him on almost any channel. Are you still have you been called by CNN Espanol at all recently?
Yes. And you know, I do all kinds of very weird media, including the Slovakia, you know, and don't even ask. It's just ridiculous. Well, after 50 years of analyzing caucuses and U.S. presidential politics, everybody has my name somewhere.
Yeah.
And this year is the most fascinating year in literally my 50 years as a political scientist, because never have we seen such contrasts between the administration in power, the opposition, which is the Democrats. And I think rarely have we seen such choices as the Democrats have in terms of what direction they will go, who they will choose to carry the flag of the Democrats
right.
in November of next year. And so, you know, we're all just chewing our nails watching all this.
Actually, it's incredible. So you do have our fascist in chief. So that's what we have going here, which I think is shocking a lot of people around the world, because, you know, America used to be, you know, the shining symbol on the hill. And now everyone's kind of going, I'm not even sure I want to stand next to the president of the United States. Can you take that seat? I don't want that seat. And then you have, I mean, which is really kind of, I mean, I don't know if I sent you the Gallup poll, but the Gallup poll is talking about how Americans are so, I mean, they're disgusted with politics. They have a low image of their own country. I mean, he's not making America great again. Everybody's trying to figure out how to immigrate to Canada. You know, it's sort of like he's doing the exact opposite, which I think is so shocking. But on the Democratic side, I mean, I every time I looked at the two debates, I can't stop smiling, even though there are still too many people up there. And that is, I mean, you've got Andrew Yang, you've got, you know, Kamala Harris, you've got Cory Booker. You've got this variety. You've got Tulsi Gabbard. You've got these old men. You've got Biden and Bernie. You know, you've got old women like Warren. I mean, it's old, it's young, it's diverse, it's oh my God. And for the
it's like going to Walmart.
It's like going to what? No. It's like going to Walmart. You're a lunatic.
It's really amazing. But you know, here in Iowa, and of course you're in New Hampshire, and it's Iowa and New Hampshire are joined at the hip on this. You know, they're coming here. They're here right now. Bernie Sanders just gave a speech and a big rally at the University of Iowa in Iowa City, and he touted the fact that he had gotten a million contributions from people, and they were all under $100. On the other hand, some of the polls are showing him slipping, including an Iowa poll, which shows both Bernie Sanders slipping, it shows Biden slipping, it shows Kamala Harris actually moving up in a very dramatic way.
Yeah.
And then you look at the national polls, which don't show that. I mean, there's a great website that covers the 2020 and the caucuses and all that. And yesterday we were talking about polls, and all of a sudden this morning I'm looking at another poll, and Biden is still holding up very well on national polls, although there are shifts with Kamala Harris improving after that dramatic debate performance. But it's so fluid, Arnie. It is truly fluid, and that's, I think, exciting. I think people will keep watching. And after all, nothing happens until February when the caucuses and then the New Hampshire primary take place. So we have a long time to go.
So let me remind you of something, though. I'm going to go back to the last time it was sort of very exciting, and that was Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And I was listening to someone this morning on one of the cable shows, but this is something I've heard in the past, having read it and everything from The American Prospect to whatever. And that was even though Barack Obama will ultimately become the first black president, a lot of people, especially within the African-American community, were very comfortable with the Clintons. Remember how they used to refer to Bill Clinton as the first African-American president, even though he
That's
was
right.
white and from Arkansas. Anyway, so Hillary, you know, remember we elected two for the price of one? That was how they ran in 92. Two for the price of one, it's how they ran in 96. So we were comfortable with Hillary, and the African-American community was very comfortable with the Clintons. So it wasn't until Barack Obama won Iowa that the African-American community said, phew, it's okay. We can now think about supporting him. And in part,
That's right.
Iowa is incredibly white, like New Hampshire is incredibly white. And
yep.
I think what they wanted to see is they wanted to believe, but they also were willing to sort of say, you know what, we have a relationship with the Clintons. We really don't have a relationship with Barack Obama. We're hopeful. It's a wonderful sign that he's even running for president. This is a good thing for us. But if he doesn't win, it's not so bad. But you know what?
Yeah.
When he won Iowa, everything changed. What is going to change both for the dynamic of this race, what is going to change for Biden and for Bernie is what happens in Iowa and New Hampshire, because that's when all of a sudden all these people who are going, this is a familiar name, but this may be the new name we need to become familiar with.
You're absolutely right. That's a wonderful summary of what happened.
Yeah.
And I would also remind your listeners, you know this, but your listeners know this as well, but it's a reminder. It took Barack Obama the entire primary season before he had enough delegates
right.
to be able to go to the Democratic convention and get nominated. I mean, we had to chew our nails on what Guam and Puerto Rico would yield in terms of delegates, and
yes.
the Virgin Islands, for
yes.
God's sake.
Yes.
It wasn't as though this thing was sealed up early and that was it. And, you know, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama fought tooth and nail for every single delegate. And I wonder if that isn't going to happen this year as well. You know, given the choices and the fact that, you know, this is a new way of choosing candidates, the whole primary system where every delegate counts, and it may take a while.
Well, and again, I think what is sort of shocking for Bernie and Bernie's followers is that Bernie, I mean, any sophisticated political analyst would have told Bernie not to run. And the reason they would have
yeah.
told Bernie not to run is because they looked at the 2018 election and realized that this is Bernie's success. His success
yeah.
isn't going to be as president of the United States. His success, what's going to be on his tombstone, is what happened in 2018, not what's going to
yeah.
lose in 2020. I mean, and that's exactly right. In a way, it's so sad because
it's
he
sad.
Could have
– Yes,
it's sad.
Sad.
It's very sad.
And it's sad because – of course, he was the one who brought up all kinds of very progressive policy choices, which many of the other Democrats have now piggybacked on.
Right.
But the problem for Bernie is that they are more dynamic. They're younger. They're the next generation. And Bernie, for all of his progressiveness and so on, he is not really much of an optimist. He's kind of a grumpy old man.
Yes.
And that is, I think, for at least my students, for example, who loved Bernie the last time around, really have spread out across the field now. They like some of the other candidates. You know, Mayor Pete is a good replacement for Sanders, and of course, Elizabeth Warren and others who are carrying that flag of very progressive ideas. And so that means Bernie is competing in a much wider market where his, you know, brand and his message, you know, isn't as powerful as it
well,
was.
Well, and let me give you an example, and that is that for example, I sent you something this morning, and this is an amazing
yeah.
story, everyone. I want people to hear this. U.S. Retail Group offers to help antitrust investigators go after Amazon and Google. All right, now listen to this. But listen, who? So I wrote this on Facebook, and I sent this to you, and I wrote,
yes.
"Hey Elizabeth,"
I wrote,
"Hey Elizabeth Warren, check out this story. Here is the nugget. A leading U.S. retail group whose members include Walmart, Target, Best Buy, and others have penned a letter to the Federal Trade Commission that details its concerns over big tech companies' dominance. The letter specifically calls out Amazon and Google for their control over the majority of internet product searches." Now, I want everyone to know, so this has been a huge issue for Elizabeth Warren, a huge
yeah.
issue. And Bernie may talk about big companies, but Elizabeth Warren understands what's happening happening at the moment. She is present at the moment. She understands the dynamics not only of the policy, but what will resonate with young voters, and she packages it in such ways. But this story, this is like a neon sign for her. Honey bun, you are on the right track. Look who's supporting you, except they don't necessarily say they're supporting Elizabeth Warren. But she now has an echo chamber, and when your echo chamber is Walmart and Target and Best Buy, that is unbelievable. They have never been an echo chamber for Bernie Sanders.
That's true. And what she needs to do is she needs to take the nut of what you just read, that letter,
yes,
and she needs to run her ads with that.
Yes, exactly.
And
right.
Then say, you know, I've said this for several years as a senator and as a candidate, because that's a very compelling endorsement of what I guess I now yield to you and to Elizabeth Warren on that. Because I mean, I like Apple and I like Amazon, and I never thought they were a big threat. And, you know, these retailers now are concerned, and so I'm going to give up. I'm going to say, yes, these companies need to
yes.
be roped in.
I love winning. I love winning. So,
and you know what? What I just did?
What?
I just did what some of the candidates, like Joe Biden, should do, which is to apologize.
Oh, actually, that is. So let me just say something. That was the strength of Mayor Pete. Mayor Pete,
yes,
basically, if nothing else, I'm not sure where Mayor Pete's going to go. He made a huge haul in the last quarter, like 25
yes,
million. He actually put Bernie to shame. Bernie only got 18 million, and Mayor Pete got 25 million. But of course, can I say this out loud? I'm not even sure. So Mayor Pete is an brilliant, openly gay, young, attractive male from South Bend. I think that there are a lot of very, very successful, wealthy, white, gay men who are in Silicon Valley, who are on Wall Street, who see someone who is very much like them, who sees someone who's very articulate, who sees someone who is not quite as progressive as Elizabeth Warren, who is not quite as progressive as some of the other candidates, who seems to – and doesn't put out a lot of policy, as you've noticed. And I think what they see in him is an opportunity like what we saw with Barack Obama to really sort of bring this young man up in a way, and I think they're cutting big checks for him. I think they're organizing for him. And that doesn't mean that I don't see a lot that I admire in him. But to a large extent, he represents an interesting piece of the demographic that tends to be a lot wealthier, a lot more educated, and are willing to cut big checks. And now look what they have. They have someone that actually looks and sounds like them running for president of the United States at a time when finally the idea of being gay is not perceived as a negative. In fact, it's being perceived as a strength. Look at the famous soccer player on the women's team. She celebrates her gayness. In fact, at the last game that they won against England, she said there has never been a soccer team anywhere where there weren't gays on the team and they weren't part of the reason for our success. I love it.
Yeah, well, you know, Mayor Pete is much more than a candidate for president.
Because, yes, he is. You're absolutely right.
He's
a moment in time.
He's showing that you know, gay doesn't mean, you know, people dressed up as women in the gay parade in New York, although that's a huge history and part of it, but that it ranges all the way across, and that it can be someone who served in the military, someone who is a mayor of a town, someone, you know, who is, as you said, very articulate, calm, not a radical at all, you know? Kind of a reassuring reinforcement of the fact that, you know, being gay ranges across all the different cultures of the United States, and that is incredibly valuable in the long run.
And let me say something else that Mayor Pete has done. He's allowed Democrats to talk about their religious values.
That's right.
And that is something that they have not been able to do. And I'm an atheist that goes to the South Congregational Church in my town. And I go because I love the community. But the assistant minister is gay. I adore him Carlos, I adore you. And so what I am seeing with Mayor Pete and what I'm seeing in my own little church is something I celebrate. But what Mayor Pete has done in a lot of ways has given voice to what a lot of other Democrats would like to give voice to, but they're somewhat terrified. And he has also legitimized that conversation. And you know why that's a good thing? Because I will tell you right now, and I think I've told you this before, I have had a number of young evangelical Christians that have lived with me. Everyone, I opened my house to law students. And it turns out two of the young men that have lived with me have actually commented in a very positive way. They're now so curious about this guy named, you know, Mayor Pete, because they hear a voice and they hear an ethic that actually they can relate to. And that is so powerful, everyone.
Well, it is. The other thing we have to remember, and somehow the Democrats don't have an elephant's memory. They have a donkey memory. Huh. And so they are not remembering that the Democratic Party, especially with Martin Luther King, with Southern blacks, was a very religion-centered party. I mean, a lot of the moral positions of the Democratic Party on social issues, on how people should relate to each other, were founded in Southern black Baptist churches.
Right.
And that has been abandoned.
Right.
I don't hear any of the Democratic candidates here in Iowa talking at all about religion and about, you know, what you might learn from at least the historical, you know, positive and in many ways very progressive messages that are in biblical writing.
So, you know,
if you're cynical, you go back and say, hey, this is what the Bible says. This is what Jesus Christ is supposed to have said about how you treat children, for example.
So,
and that could be used very positively to neutralize some of the viciousness that is going on in how children are being treated on the Mexican border in the United States. I mean, if you go to the Bible for that, it's got to embarrass some of the evangelicals and others who seem to be okay with the policies that are being implemented.
I want to go to the pro-life party. I want to talk to the pro-life party and ask them about, okay, so what about these lives? Are these lives expendable? These lives, people have died in custody with the United States. People have died going across the river because the line was so long and the dates were so long because we haven't funded the number of judges and the number of lawyers that we could actually do to make this actually a much more positive and responsive thing. I want to talk to the pro-life Republicans and talk about what kind of lives are you talking about? This is so outrageous. And I want to say something else. I want to go back to sort of the religious conversation that has now been somewhat legitimized by Mayor Pete. And I want to talk about two things. One, whenever I talk about climate change, I use a language from the Jewish community. And what the Jews say is they're not quite sure if there's a heaven. But what they say is their obligation is to make your heaven here. That is your obligation. And if you are to make your heaven here, then you have to be good stewards of the planet. You have to protect us from climate change. You have to protect us from the kind of degradation you see. And that is something where I can actually quote the Jewish community. When Mitt Romney was running for president, you know what I was begging him to talk about? I wanted some kind of universal service. I believe that we all should contribute, that is part of being a citizen, is giving back. And what I wanted Mitt Romney to talk about is what the Mormons do. And what are the Mormons do? You spend 2 years of your life giving back to the church, whether it's singing in the Mormon Tabernacle Choir or whether it's proselytizing or whether it's working wherever. The idea of that is the connective tissue to your church. We need connective tissue to our country. Those are two religious examples that Arnie the atheist or the agnostic can use today and say it is okay to talk about this because in the end, aren't these our values?
That's right. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a believer to accept some of the teachings that are constructive, that are kind, that are generous and are, you know, oriented towards humanity. And it is distressing at the very least and frightening to see what's going on. You got to remember that when you show these pictures of men jammed into a women's detention center where there isn't enough room for them to even sit down, they're standing up for days. in this detention center when they show a picture of the Salvadoran who drowned with his daughter crossing the river. Trump administration is thrilled because that's exactly the objective of all these policies, is to send a really terrifying message to Central America saying to people, don't come up here because you're going to be locked up in a room with no food, no water, standing up. You're going to drown coming here, so don't come here. People seem to think that this is a failure of the system or a mistake that's being made. My view and the view of some analysts is that this is very deliberate, that this is specifically intended to say we are not a friendly place. Don't come here.
Well, I think it's actually I think it's also feeding his base. And the reason why he doesn't want them to stop coming. He needs them to keep coming because this is the way he keeps his base riled up. This is like red meat to the base, just like what he's doing when the Mueller report. So Mueller is going to come to testify. You saw this. Mueller's coming to testify.
Yep.
And what is he doing on the day that Mueller's coming to testify? He's holding a damn political rally. I mean, the guy is so obvious. Everything about this, what's happening at the border, it's not about lives. It's not about telling them not to come. It is about his personal political theater. What is he doing when the day Mueller testifies? It's about his personal political theater. What does he do with the North Korean dictator when he walks into North Korea? It's not about resolving any problems with North Korea. It's the political theater. We're all being pawns in his play. This is a play. It's the Donald Trump play. None of it has a connection to policy. He doesn't want things to get better. He wants them to get worse because getting worse actually is his strength, not his liability.
But it is a great reality show.
Oh, my God.
It's a reality show. And politics in many ways is theater. Politics is not reality. It's a fantasy. Politicians promise you every kind of thing you can imagine, even if they know. And all politicians do this, even if they can't deliver. And so in some respects, at least, President Trump is just extending, stretching, and seeing what the limits are of how far you can do this. And it's the same thing with presidential power. The Constitution does not really define very carefully what presidential power is, you know, what executive privilege is. It just says this is, you know, what you have. And then the presidents in Washington can try to use it however they think it will work. And President Trump has, in an amazing way, stretched the power of the presidency probably as far as any president in the history of this country.
Well,
and nobody can stop him.
Congress can't stop him.
The courts are beginning to stop him, though.
Yeah.
The courts are beginning to assert themselves. And, you know, the telling the president, nope, you can't put, are you a U.S. citizen in the census? Wow. And the Census Bureau dropped that from yesterday, dropped it because the court said, nope, you can't do this. So that's interesting because it shows a certain amount, I think, now of pushback.
Well, it shows us, it does show a certain amount of pushback. But at the same time, obviously, I'm really worried about how the court's going to fare next year. I mean, we're already beginning to see it become more and more reactionary and more conservative. And, you know, I mean, I hope Ruth Bader Ginsburg is taking her vitamins because I am just absolutely terrified about what the replacement will look like because it's going to be an absolutely frightening situation.
And so, she has to watch it when she crosses the street.
Oh, that's – stop it. You know, I'm thinking about this is going to be airing the day after Trump's parade in Washington, D.C.
The great parade with the tanks.
With the tanks and the flyovers. And it just turns out that the National Park Service has had to redirect $2.5 million in order to accommodate his ego trip.
It'll be a spectacular event, though. President Macron should fly in and sit there with Trump and say, oh, this is the best military parade I have ever seen. It's better than ours.
Well,
that's where President Trump got the idea. Of course. The French parade that he saw, Bastille Day, I think. And he was just totally impressed with how the French touted their military and stuff like that.
Well, look at this. Look what the Saudis did when he went to visit Saudi Arabia.
Yes,
remember how they
yes.
treated him? I mean, they treated him like his you-know-what didn't smell. It's just – it's absolutely, absolutely outrageous. But Dahlia Lithwick – I'm going to end with this. Dahlia Lithwick of Slate.com asks this question. Will Donald Trump's 4th of July parade break the law? The Hatch Act prevents the president from spending tax dollars on a political rally. Here's what would turn his parade into an illegal act. I love you, Dahlia Lithwick. I love you, Stefan Schmidt. Everyone, we are taping this on July 3rd. I need to wish Stefan Schmidt a happy 4th of July. You'll be hearing this on Friday. It is our Friday show. Talk to you next week, Stefan. Talk to you next week, everyone. You better-